So 2 weeks ago, if you can remember back that far, we covered the moral argument for God's existence, which was our third argument of for God's existence. We talked that this argument goes something like this. Objective moral values and duties exist. Objective moral values and duties must be grounded in an unchanging and rational mind, rules out human minds. Therefore, objective moral values are grounded in an unchanging rational mind, and this unchanging rational mind is what we call God. However, I did want to talk about what the moral argument does not. It does not claim atheists are immoral or that they can't live moral lives. It does not need everyone to agree on what morality is, what right and wrong are. And it does not necessarily deal with the problem of evil. Though I say necessarily because it can, but it's not its primary purpose. When making arguments for God's existence, you want to claim as little as possible, so you have to defend as little as possible. All the moral argument claims is that objective morality exists and that it must be grounded in a rational mind. Nothing more. So you're defending those two premises. So if you can show somebody they're appealing to an objective standard of morality outside themselves and then say, hey, how do you justify you appealing to that standard? That's all the moral argument is, and that's all it's trying to prove. So all the other things, like up here on the screen, are not cause for objection, nor do they make the moral argument fail and not be able to work. So that's kind of what we walked through last week. We talked about how there were objective moral standards and values and duties, and that how they must be grounded in a rational mind. So turning now to week four, we are going to cover, there's a lot we want to get through, so I want to be a little bit faster paced. But we didn't just get back from vacation, so if I sound a little bit confusing or out of it, please stop and ask me, because I am tired. It was a long week and a lot of driving. It was fun, but I am tired. This week we will cover our final argument for God's existence, which is an argument from information. We will then conclude our section on arguments for and begin our section on arguments against God's existence, beginning today with two pop arguments, as I call them. By pop arguments, I mean they're commonly used and sound great to the common person, but don't hold much water when really thought through, and most academics won't argue them. You don't hear them like in high level, you know, philosophical debates because they're not taken seriously. But you will encounter them online or in the street or whatever. A reminder of our goals for this course. One being to learn to love the Lord our God with all of our minds. Number two, to fulfill the command and example of apologetics in Scripture. And number three, to better prepare ourselves when storms in life come and bring doubt with them. Now we will begin our argument from information, our final argument for God's existence. In his book, Stealing from God, Frank Turek outlines a story of an atheist who complains there is no evidence for God. So Frank asked the atheist, "What kind of evidence would you want?" And the atheist responded, "Why can't God say, 'Hey Roger, this is God, I certainly do exist, now stop all your whining down there.' Why can't he write that in the sky and the stars or something?" Now, why would this guy named Roger find that a compelling piece of evidence? Any thoughts? Why would that be convincing of God's existence? It's empirical evidence. Can you break down that word for us, Jeffrey? Empirical evidence is something you can take in with the senses. Right. It's empirical evidence. Any other ideas as to why that would be convincing? Hey, Roger, it's me, God. I certainly do exist. Personal, okay? You know, it's specific, right? It's, hey, Roger. It's specific to him. It couldn't have evolved over time. It rules out chance because it would have happened immediately. And because natural laws or nature don't form messages like that. Only intelligent minds do. So the stars wouldn't randomly organize to say, hey, Roger, this is God. An intelligent mind would have to do that. Well, see, and that's always the response I give to you know, if God exists or if Jesus rose from the dead, why doesn't he just appear to me and make it personal for me? And I would say, well, you would still want to non-believe, or you would still want to not believe. So you would just say, well, I'm hallucinating or something. You would find some reason to not believe. Yeah. Right. Right. Absolutely. So this guy complains, why doesn't God write a message to me to prove he exists? But in fact, there's messages much longer than, hey, Roger, this is God, that are contained in all life forms. Dr. Stephen Meyer wrote a book called Darwin's Doubt, which is a reference to Charles Darwin, who started the theory of evolution. Dr. Meyer went through the same process Darwin did, looking at forensic evidence left behind by fossils and other sources, and he also reasoned to the best explanation, just like Darwin did. However, Dr. Meyer reached a different conclusion than Darwin reached, because he had more information than Darwin did when he had his theory in 1859. The message that is longer than, hey, Roger, this is God, and the one that the information that Dr. Meyer knew about that Darwin didn't, is written in the DNA of every human. Who knows who Bill Gates is? Founder of Microsoft, the guy who writes code. Bill Gates said, human DNA is like a computer software, but far, far more advanced than any software created. He is right in saying this, because inside every cell in your body, there is contained DNA, which is 300 billion characters long. Each one of these characters needs to be correct, in correct order, barring a rare error, for you to survive. Now, famous atheist and biologist Richard Dawkins said that just a single cell contains as much information as 1,000 encyclopedias. Now, Dr. Meyer writes in his book that the same way a pen and paper are responsible for the words on a page, but aren't responsible for what the marks mean, so it is with our DNA. So the pen and paper is like the physical ink and paper, but it doesn't write the message that's on the paper. In the same way, the laws of nature and chemistry can be responsible for what those characters are, but they're not responsible for what the ordering of those characters or what all those little letters mean. So believing that an explosion caused your DNA to be ordered in just the right way is like believing an explosion in a print shop was responsible for the writing of 1,000 encyclopedias. It just doesn't make any sense. Messages need intelligent minds. And this coding in our genetics can't be a product of evolution or natural selection, because natural selection implies there's something to select. But we're not asking how the letters came to be selected. We're asking where did they come from in the first place. Natural selection can't just bring in all these characters. It can select them, but it can't create them. And so to this, evolution has no answer. So information scientist Hubert Yahya made it clear that the analogy of the DNA code to the English alphabet is not just an analogy, but a one-to-one comparison when he said, it is important to understand that we are not reasoning by analogy. The sequence hypothesis applies directly to the protein and the genetic text as well as to a written language, and therefore treatment is mathematically identical. All of that means is that it's a one-to-one comparison between the English language and your genetic code. And so if the English language needs an intelligent mind to form a message and to form meaning, so does your genetic code. And so thus, the genetic code in our DNA points to a highly intelligent mind that created it.
You know, while you got that up there, every one of those little atoms or molecules in the DNA molecule, as you're showing there, that's three sequences right there, and it's 3 billion of those that make up my DNA, and every single cell in your body, and there are like 3 trillion of them in your body, has a code in it that's identical one to one to one, and that's fine. The deal is, so what you're saying is, the concept, you can physically build a DNA molecule, but the smallest one, as far as I know, is 145,000 of those little sequences long, the simplest thing on Earth, some protein or whatever. But the deal is, okay, these are all just, this is chemicals, this is elements that make up those molecules, and that's fine. I mean, that's the equivalent, they always say, if you put a bomb in a junkyard or the other, and boom, it blows up, and out comes a 747. Well, that happened. Let's just say that occurred. But what's the problem with it? The 747 or the helicopter just sits there because it has no information of how to operate. Well, that sequence not only tells a cell or the material how to build the thing, which is you or me or a plant or an amoeba or fill in the blank, but it also has the information, as you write on there, to tell it how to operate. And that's the impossibility without a mind telling it, here's how you do this. Here's the 747. Here's the helicopter. Now here's the information that you got to put a pilot in it, and he has to be able to function and run that helicopter. And it's the same for our DNA. The chemical structure is one thing. The other concept is, where does the information come from to tell that cell to build a bone cell instead of a brain cell or a skin cell or a muscle cell?
That's actually another argument for God's existence that's separate from this one, which is the goal-directedness of the universe. And by that, I mean how everything's in order. You know, if an acorn drops into the ground, it doesn't make a random tree. It always makes the same tree, you know. And so animals reproduce not into different animals. They're always reproducing into the same kind. And so the goal-directedness of the universe is another argument for God's existence, because you need some sort of mind behind that too. But this is strictly, there's 300 billion characters in your DNA, and a message that long as 1,000 encyclopedias inside one cell, that cries out for a mind that leaves that there. And natural processes cannot explain that. So it's begging for a mind to explain that. So we're going to now move to a little recap as we close out our sections for arguments for God and his existence. We have covered a total in four. If you remember the Kalam cosmological argument, which is the argument from the beginning of the universe, the teleological argument, which is the fine-tuning of the universe, Jeffrey's favorite, the moral argument, which we covered 2 weeks ago, and an argument from information. And I say that because there's many different arguments from information, as Rick was starting to touch on. It's not just the DNA in your cell. There's a lot of things where you can make an argument from information like that. There's also many more arguments for God in general. In fact, famous Christian philosopher and Notre Dame professor Alvin Plantinga wrote a book called 2 Dozen or So Arguments for God, in which he offers more than 24 different arguments for God's existence. And it's really fascinating. So there are many more arguments than just the four we touched on briefly in this class, and there's a lot more to all of these four. And I would encourage you to go and explore these further, or you can come talk to me about them, or anything like that. Yeah.
So 2 weeks ago, when you were here last time, I probably argued with you a little bit about the moral argument, so I'm willing to use your term to do that. And I just wanted to add to what I had to say that I'm not disagreeing with you in any way. In fact, I just wanted to say I would guess that most of us feel the same way. This is so needed, this class. I am grateful. Throughout our time, we have been very involved initially with the youth group here, with kids at camp. And I cannot tell you how many kids who seem to have such a strong faith in God no longer have a faith in God because they do not have a foundation for truth. And to me, we have lacked sharing this kind of truth with our youth to let them know that there is an absolute truth. And if they can be strong and secure in it, it doesn't make them stupid. It makes them really smart. It makes them intelligent and to be able to really critically think. And I would say that every one of us here needs to get our arms around this, and we need to share it with the youth because they true. There's truth, and there's an argument for God. And so I'm grateful for you. And I just wanted to say that because I did argue back and forth with you a little bit, and that's a little bit how I'm built. If anybody knows me very well, I like to argue a little bit. I think you probably do too. So forgive me, but I just this is so needed.
It's not arguing; it's a debate.
No, I thank you very much for saying that. And if you remember in the beginning, the first week we talked about why this is so important, and that was one of the reasons I gave, was because it's so important to the youth and to the next generation. And yes, Alan bought me a book called Tactics, which is learning how to share your Christian faith with those around you. And in it, the author had a quote that he had a chapter on was, where debate lacks, errors abound. And the point was that if you're not conversing or struggling intellectually, then you're just not going to talk about your differences, and you're not going to point out errors in each other's thinking. But if you have two people who can come together and sharpen iron with iron and say, oh, look, I think your reasoning is bad there. Oh, wait, I think you're right. Let me just change that. That's a much better way of doing it. And if you can do that civilly and respectfully, that's the goal of that. But the moral argument is hard to grasp. It took me a while to get it or to like explain it. And I think it's much easier when you see it in practice to go, oh, I understand how that works. Like I can get it and I can list out the premises and support them, but it's much easier to grasp it if you see somebody use it in general. For example, there's this guy who goes out on the street and he talks to people about abortion and other moral issues. And he knows the moral argument in and out. And so I've learned the moral argument by watching him use it in practice. And it's one of those things, it's much easier to use, or much easier to learn seeing somebody use it in practice. And, oh, I see how that works. I see how that, you know, implies a God. But yeah, it is a difficult one to kind of get. So, yeah. Well, I'm about to get there. No, you can keep going. I'm just saying I'm about to get there. Right, and this is a good segue. And I would encourage you, there's my favorite personal apologist, his name is William Lane Craig, and he encourages Christians to be able to memorize five arguments or reasons to believe in God. He goes, you don't even need the premises or need to be know how to defend them, but if you can list five reasons, God's the best explanation for the beginning of the universe, he's the best explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe, he's the best explanation for morality. If you can just list reasons like that, that's enough for people to go, oh, you know. And you don't have to have all of this off the top of your head, but being able to give some sort of reply like that is of utmost importance. So these arguments that we covered, these four, the kalam, the teleological, the moral, and an argument from information, these are the qualities of what we get from each argument. So you have spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, personal, intelligent, singular, highly intelligent, detail-oriented, morally perfect, personal, intimately concerned with human morality, highly intelligent, intimately involved. So these qualities, we haven't gotten to the Christian God yet, right? The Kalam cosmological argument does not lead us to belief in Yahweh. It leads us to a belief in general theism. But without ever opening a religious book, we can show that a being with these qualities exists, right? And so there's other things that bring us to a belief in the Christian God, because right now, this God could be the God of Islam. It could be the God of Christianity. It could be a thousand other gods, right? But we aren't using the Bible to prove the Bible here. We're simply reasoning from facts to the most logical conclusion, and it can show an atheist that, hey, apart from any religious book, just from looking at nature, you can understand that a being with these qualities exists. And like I said, we haven't established that this is Yahweh, the God of the Bible, yet. And for that, you look at the resurrection of Jesus, because if Jesus claims to be Yahweh in the flesh and then is raised from the dead, that's vindication of his claim to be God. And then that's how we kind of get to, well, this being is the Christian God. But we'll get there. That's down the line. That's in a couple weeks.
You have to realize, too, you're speaking to people who are not neutral. You're speaking to people whose hearts are desperately wicked above all things. You're speaking to people who don't want a God of any kind. So even though you present these things, don't be surprised if people go, nah.
Well, yeah, we're actually going to get to that. They don't want to believe it. Man, you guys are good at keeping me rolling here. So now this is officially recapping our four arguments for God's existence, and these are the qualities of a theistic being that we get from natural theology. So we can say a being with these qualities exists, and, you know, Paul says you can look up in the stars in Romans 1, you can see by the work of his hands that God exists. I think this is partly what he's talking about. You can see that some sort of divine being exists. Without ever opening a religious book. And that's the whole purpose of natural theology, is to show, hey, we don't have to use a religious book to point out that God exists. You can look at this and kind of reason. And like I said, there's more than two dozen arguments that kind of go in this line. But now we're going to turn to arguments against God's existence. And we're going to cover two popular arguments that are kind of street level. There's a lot of popular arguments that sound really good but aren't really that good at all. But we only are going to have time for two, I believe. And then we're going to talk about the problem of pain, evil, and suffering, because that's the biggest objection to God's existence. We're going to spend all of next week on that. So, these popular arguments are, like I said, ones that aren't really taken seriously in amongst scholars, but they're ones you hear online or in the street that sound really good. And so our first of these is, if God exists, why doesn't he make it blatantly obvious? If God exists and wants to bring everybody into a saving relationship with himself, why wouldn't he make it clear that he existed? Why wouldn't he make sure everybody knew that Jesus rose from the dead and Christianity was true? This objection is also known as divine hiddenness. If God exists, why isn't he as clear as the nose on your face? This assumes that if given the proper evidence, humans would believe something, which is absolutely ridiculous. For example, the people of Israel, they see blatantly that God exists. They walk through the Red Sea on dry ground, and 2 months later they're building a calf at the base of Mount Sinai. So even if you had a miracle like the parting of the Red Sea, humans don't have a good track record with that. Humans oftentimes fall away. And it's not necessarily that they don't believe. They just don't want to believe despite the evidence.
Yeah, in that particular case that you just gave, what is always amazing to me is they had the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night.
Oh, yeah.
That was a physical presence of something greater than them, always visible to them. And in spite of the visible evidence, that it became so, I don't want to say so common, but I think it lost its awe and wonder. And
right.
So they just forgot about it.
Take it for granted, if you will. But there are many studies that back up and show that humans will believe what they want to believe, even if it flies in the face of the evidence, not just with religion, but with anything. And even atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel admits this by saying, it isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. And he goes on to say that he believes many of his colleagues share the same view and that this view is responsible for their way of thinking. And so, since we're not omniscient, who is to say God has not given enough evidence for everyone to believe? or at least will give them that in their lifetime. But they have just rejected it because they don't want to believe it. It seems as if God has given ample evidence to those who he knows will freely choose to love him, but not so much evidence as to force people to believe into something against their will. As William Lane Craig, a Christian philosopher, would put it, God has given evidence sufficiently clear for those with an open heart, but sufficiently vague as to not compel those whose hearts are closed. So William Lane Craig has also said of this, that if God made his existence as blatant as the nose on your face, it would irritate people, and it would make him like a cosmic babysitter, and it would have the opposite intended effect. Think about it. If you have a helicopter parent, a parent who's always watching over you and breathing down your neck, kids rebel against the helicopter parent. So if God was ever existent, like in our everyday lives, and we always knew he was there, it might cause people to rebel more than it would to obey him. And besides, God isn't interested in simply getting people to believe that he exists. God is interested in bringing people into a saving relationship with him. And so if everybody believed that he existed but rebelled because he was blatantly there and breathing down your neck all the time, that wouldn't serve God's purposes. So God knows what is best to do in order to draw the most amount of people toward him into a saving relationship with himself. And who knows? This is apparently the best way for him to do that, is to not be apparent as day. And there's reasons for that, as I just covered that William Lane Craig said. So our second argument is, if God created everything, who created God? Who's heard this one, or at least thought about it? Pretty popular, right? Okay. So this one is not even used by atheist philosophers, but is instead a very common argument by the layman on the internet. So it kind of fits in this section. If God created the universe, who created God? Who created the being who created God? And so on and so forth, back into the eternity in the past. But just because Christians argue that the universe was created, it doesn't imply that everything that exists needs a creator. For example, in the Kalam cosmological argument, the one we covered, everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe had a cause, therefore the universe began to exist. Or the universe began to exist, therefore it has a cause. So it doesn't say everything that exists has a cause, rather everything that begins to exist has a cause. And as Tom has memorized, one of the qualities we get from the being, or from the Kalam cosmological argument, is that he's timeless. And so if you're timeless, you're without beginning. He always was, he is, and he always will be. There is no beginning. So you can't have a cause for something without a beginning. All of a sudden, then you're asking the question, what was the cause of an uncaused thing? And it's just a nonsensical question. And that's kind of what it's like asking who created God.
It's interesting. In, I think it's Titus, one of the Timothy's, it's a statement that says God did this before time began. And that phrase is just, it just takes him past any time whatsoever. He did, he thought, he planned before time even existed. You know, it puts him outside of our universe as we know it.
Right, absolutely. And there's other arguments that we haven't covered, such as the Leibnizian cosmological argument, which says that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, whether in the necessity of its being or a cause. And so God, by definition, is a being who exists of his own necessity, who doesn't have a cause. Well, for the reasons we covered in the Kalam, that this being has to be singular. Because if you have a timeless being is infinite, right? And what makes two beings differ from one another is that one lacks something the other has. What makes me and Jeffrey different is I lack his public speaking ability, right? But an infinite being lacks nothing. Therefore, there can't be two infinite beings because one, they would be the same being. Because if they're infinite, they have all qualities and they don't lack anything. And so there can only be one infinite being. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to everybody else? That's how we get singular out of the Kalam. Well, the doctrine of the Trinity is one being in three persons, which is a distinction to make. And we actually talked about how God being morally perfect and being all loving implies the Trinity. We kind of threw that in at the end of the last 2 weeks ago. Because for you to love somebody, you need another person to love. So how can God be love before he creates the angels or creates man? It implies that, you know, there's been a co-equal, co-eternal love going on between at least two persons in a Godhead. But we obviously believe there's three. And we'll talk more about that later on in a couple weeks. Does everybody kind of get that? And if you also remember, during our section on the Kalam, we talked a little bit about an infinite regress of causes and how that's mathematically impossible, that you can't have an infinite number of things going into the past. Aristotle, who's heard of Aristotle? Anybody? Okay. Aristotle said of this, at some point you have to get to what he called an unmoved mover or an uncaused first cause, something that caused everything, but it itself was not caused, because an infinite regress of causes is mathematically impossible. So if you can say, well, hey, God doesn't need a cause, you know, and they accept that, the obvious objection that follows is, well, if God didn't have a cause, why can't the universe be the same way? You know, if nothing created God, why can't I say, well, nothing created the universe? Wouldn't that just make as much sense? And the objection to this, or the answer back, is because all of the scientific evidence that we covered previously over the last 100 years says that the universe most definitely did have a cause and began to exist. And so that's something that people are having to tackle now. Scientists are having to tackle now. So there's this famous atheist named Richard Dawkins. He wrote a book called The God Delusion. And essentially the premise of the entire book is if God exists, who created God? And he thinks it's like a great knockdown argument. But atheist philosopher Michael Ruse, who is much higher up on the, you know, atheist scale than Richard Dawkins, despite how popular Richard Dawkins is, he said, Christians have got some grown-up responses to these sorts of things, and I think that Richard Dawkins does a serious disservice to the cause of unbelief by not being prepared to take seriously the kinds of things that believers believe in. Meaning that the higher-level atheist philosophers don't see this objection as holding any water, and they're critiquing their own atheists by saying, look, you're an embarrassment to atheism by raising these sorts of objections, because Christians have good answers to questions like, who created God? So, this has been week 4 of our study through apologetics. We covered an argument for information. In it, we saw how there are messages 3 billion characters long in our DNA that cry out for an intelligent mind to be their author. We also looked at 2 common objections to God used by laymen most often, including, if God exists, why doesn't he make himself more obvious? And we saw that humans would reject him because they want to believe what they want to believe, and that God knows how to bring the most amount of people into a saving relationship with himself, and so not revealing himself directly must be the best way to do that. The second one was, if God created everything, who created God? We saw this is wrong for many reasons, and is like asking a nonsensical question. For example, the Kalam argues that the cause of the universe must be timeless, and therefore, by definition, is without a cause. So God, by definition, is a being that is uncaused. There are many other I would have loved to cover, such as religion is used for power and to control people and is abused like that. There's a bunch of those kind of popular arguments, but you can pull study after study to show that religion and Christianity are positively correlated with democracy and improvement and women's rights and better food and more education and higher literacy rates. You can find all of those studies that show that the objection that Christianity is harmful is just absolutely bogus. But looking ahead, we will begin next week with the problem of pain, evil, and suffering. Any thoughts or questions? Absolutely. That's absolutely right. So Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2 that people are headed for destruction because they did not receive the love of the truth, and so God sends on them a powerful delusion and essentially lets them believe an error. And so I don't think he's saying they didn't receive the truth. I think he's saying they didn't receive the love of the truth, in the sense that they wanted to believe what they wanted to believe, and they didn't love the truth and say, look, if I'm wrong, I'd rather be wrong but be right with God than be right with my own pride and wrong with God. And so I never want to be the person that says, you know, I was born this way, I was raised this way, I'm always going to believe this. This is something that Jeffrey's drilled into me, actually. But I think it's always important to be intellectually honest and say, you know, are my beliefs really accurate? You know, does this really make sense? Or am I just holding this because I've always been taught this? Or because I just dogmatically want to believe it? You know, it's important to check our own biases. And I said that in the beginning, that I thought intellectual honesty and humility were some of the most important traits that you could have as a human. Because with those, you're going to be genuinely seeking. And if you have the humility to say, hey, look, I'm wrong, you know, so if me and Krista are going back and forth and she points something out to me, I'm like, you know what? I think you're right on that. I should change. And there's nothing wrong with that, because the goal isn't to win the argument. The goal is that we're both right with God. And so when you go into it with that view, the goal, you know, it's not all of a sudden, oh, I'm trying to win the argument. It's, oh, we're trying to seek truth together. We're not arguing each other. We're arguing for truth together, even though it looks like, hey, I think you're wrong here. What do you think about this? But yeah, and I think that absolutely has to be done in a civil manner with, you know, both people. Yeah.
So I think, you know, a lot of times we do a disservice to ourselves, right? Somebody says what they believe and we tell them why they're wrong, which I think most of us know that that's not going to get us anywhere, right? I mean, that's just going to end up in making someone defensive and digging their heels in. And when I was in sales training years ago, one of the things that I heard, and I love this question, I think it's perfect for a moment like this. Somebody says something,
absolutely.
But that opens the door, because we start this argument, and it may not be the right argument, but we want to understand why they feel the way they do. We may not come out with a different result, but we value them, and we try to understand why they feel the way they do, and then we can take a deeper dive into the correct kind of path to take with those folks. But too often we're ready to tell them.
Right, and you're gonna hear me reference this book that Alan got me a lot, and I recommend it. It's a 10 out of 10 book, and he's not here today while I'm talking about it. But it's called Tactics by Greg Kokel, and it's a game plan for sharing your Christian faith. And so it's learning how to take this information and then go and share it. And he has you talk to people, and when somebody says, like, I don't believe God exists, instead of, he actually said, instead of jumping down their throat with the Kalam cosmological argument, if you even understand it enough to explain it, you can simply ask the question, what do you mean by that? And then when they explain that, how'd you come to that conclusion? You know, and then you're asking them to provide evidence for what they think. And now the burden of proof is completely all on them, and you're in the driver's seat of the conversation, and you don't have to be worried because you're not defending anything. And then all you can do at the end is, well, have you ever considered this? Or can I suggest to you this alternative? And so you're hearing them out, and it gives you, when you do it in that way, it gives you time to think. You're doing it in a polite Christian manner. You know, you're keeping with the character of Christ. And it gives you time to think if you're like listening and hearing their argument or the way they think. You're like, ah, there's the error there. Let me show them that that doesn't make sense. And of course, I wouldn't use that word. I wouldn't say, hey, that doesn't make sense. Why do you think like that? I would say, well, have you considered that this makes more sense? And the way you word it and the tone you use is of utmost importance. But just asking those kind of questions and hearing them out, not only does it keep you in the driver's seat and make them defend their view and you aren't defending it, but it also makes them feel heard, and like you're genuinely considering it. And so also asking those questions hooks people in and engages them into the conversation, because now they're conversing with you. But if you just jump down and start, you know, hammering out arguments, that doesn't do you any good. But I mean, they're going to just shut down. So hooking them in with questions keeps them talking.
I just wanted to add one thing. I wish that I had known more about apologetics when I moved to Myanmar, but one thing that I really had to learn while I was there was when I would meet with friends who were Buddhist or Muslim, and hoping that I could like plant certain seeds with them, you have to remember too that everybody that you're interacting with believes what they believe just about as strongly as you believe what you believe. So you're not going to convince someone in one conversation or, I don't know what I'm looking for, but just like in a manner of respect, I guess. When you're trying to win hearts over for God, it's not about you're wrong and here's the truth. Like, they believe the same thing. I'm wrong and they know the truth. So I don't know, it's just something that I try to keep in mind. I know that I know the real truth, but that doesn't necessarily... It doesn't give me an upper hand in a conversation with that person. Like, I'm not any better than they are, if that makes sense.
Right.
In a conversation, we are equals. And what they believe is just as equally worthy of respect, I guess. I don't know. Just keeping the mindset that people believe what they believe as strongly as we do. So that's part of the teaching the truth and love. I think that's where that comes in. This is all amazing stuff, but the way that you go about it with people is the most important part.
And especially if you're able to use this stuff to point out some kind of flaws, right? Learn it, that person then coping with that. And, you know, let's say they were a Muslim and they've been a Muslim all their life, you know, and they're raised that way and they'd have to leave their parents and their family would shun them. Like, beginning to come to the conclusion that something you believed all your life is wrong is not something that happens overnight. And so being patient and kind with those people, even if they retaliate because they're kind of sensing that, is always the right answer. And there's a bunch of Christian testimonies of people who it's taken them a long time to convert from Islam to Christianity because of reasons such as that. So, yeah, that's a very good point.
Did you get the handout?
There are handouts in the back in case anybody did not get one. There are handouts for this week in the back. And there will always be handouts each week on the back table for you to pick up for class. Thank you.